This is a back and forth, but it's obvious that they're being targeted for what looks like political persecution.
Mondays with Mike.
Mondays with Mike.
So apparently there's a big winter storm barreling across the U.S. as of January 24th. It's probably somewhat resolved, but there was a lot of talk on the news about it. And unlike some of the alarmism that I see on there, I think I better understand what the role of television news is now than I did. That it's one-third current events, one-third warning bulletins, one-third entertainment, and it's not exactly the sober, considered takes you get from single-author-based things. But looks like a pretty bad storm. There were frozen lighthouses, temps negative 50, including wind chill. There was thunder snow in New York, and it's not going to heat up
until Wednesday, according to NBC News.
Over half of the U.S. population is impacted by this, including many in the South who weren't used to the cold temperatures. I don't know what this brings up for you. It brings up for me questions of urban design.
I was thinking about, when I first heard about this, that there's certain places that are designed to withstand the cold. So there's two places in particular I was thinking about. There's a place in Alaska called Whittier, Alaska, where pretty much the entire town lives in one building. They live in a 14-story condominium, and the entire town is designed around surviving very low temperatures because the way that they navigate the town is really unique. And then there's another place that's really fascinating, which is Fermont, Canada, and they have a huge building. If you look at it, a picture of it, or you look at it on a map, it's gigantic, and it shields the whole town from the ice and the snow and the cold. They call it the wall, Le Mur, because it's a gigantic building meant to protect the smaller buildings from the elements. And it's huge. It's gigantic. Fermont, Canada. Yeah, no, I think you're right that there is a need. A part of the issue for why this storm has such a great effect is that there's all these little towns all over the country, and there's such great distances that it's not so easy to protect some of the roadways. It's not so easy to get emergency services everywhere they need to be in time. Ice and snow, they pose real risks to people if they're not prepared. You see it time and again, actually, in the South. I think one year, Texas, their energy grid went down or something because it was too cold. That was bad. But you also see it with, I was just watching a video of a multi-car pileup because the cars weren't set up to drive on ice and they didn't see the ice on the highway. And so one car after another just slammed right into the cars in front of them because they didn't see the ice. They weren't prepared for the black ice on the roads. And if you don't know what to look for when you're driving, it can get really difficult really fast for an inexperienced driver when inclement weather conditions hit. No, I understand why the news is focusing on this because of just the sheer number of people involved, right? The national media covers national events, and this is an event that is affecting over 100 million people. That's a lot of people, right? That's a huge swath of the country is under this weather warning. I saw that it was more than 20 states have declared weather emergencies. If you want to get people to take something seriously, you make it seem serious. And in this case, I think this is serious enough to merit being discussed, right? In terms of being a weather event, just because of the sheer magnitude of it.
Yeah, I think that you put it well when you say you have all these towns, they're all out by themselves, and it does create logistical cost incumbent in the suburban sprawl that we have is the logistical cost. Because, like, a suburban home, a great place, yeah, sure, a great place, I'd say, to kind of get away, go, and probably most times nobody's going to bug you. But at the same time, you're not, like, 30 minutes from a grocery store. Because I was thinking about, there are all these houses in the South, and during an extreme weather event, which we seem to be seeing more and more, are they prepared? They have to go through it. It's a whole big thing. but they're necessarily going to be isolated from their neighbors, largely isolated for a number of days. And just like going back in the course of human evolution, going back tens of thousands of years and prior, so like most of the human evolutionary timescale, I would think about how little the human is built for that. So we're not built for that. But like the built environment, that's the choice that most people are given, and the choice many people aspire after. I don't know. Do you think it's easier to care for people? Care for is not exactly the word. Do you think it's easier to logistically support people if they're concentrated in like smaller areas, even if we're talking like towns, if those towns are like linked by railroads? Do you think that would make this process easier and would make these crises less of crises?
I do. So the reason for that is that cities concentrate services and resources. So if you need to go to a doctor, or you need to go to put out a fire, or you need help with just basic law enforcement, it's all there, right? The whole issue with some of these smaller towns is that there's no unanimity of agreement between these towns as to how money should be spent. The thing I think about when I think of small town America is that some of the highest paid public officials in the country, there's two groups that get paid the most. There's college professional sports coaches get paid a very high amount of money. Think the head basketball coach, head football coach at universities, they get paid a lot. And then the other group that gets paid just an exorbitant amount of money compared to some of the other public jobs that exist in the country are some people on councils. There's one city in California in particular, I remember, where they're getting six figures and in some cases, seven figure incomes. They were making over $1 million a year.
Was that Commerce, California? Could that have been?
I'm not sure. But the point I'm making is that in some cities and some localities, the voters aren't as effective at keeping their elected representatives accountable to maintaining the roads well enough, making sure there's enough salt, making sure that everything works when it needs to work. What you get is this sort of inconsistent approach to some of these towns and some of these roads and some of these places, and that poses its own separate risk when these weather events occur. And that's just a function of democracy, frankly, is that just some places aren't as effective at electing leaders who will focus on primarily the welfare of the citizens in the place, that part of it is a grift, right? That people are getting elected into political office and then using the office to just keep giving themselves money. That's a whole issue. It's not common, but it does happen. And so that's one of the issues. The thing about major cities and major urban environments is it's much easier in an election because they have a much better reportage, as it were, the news reporters that focus on city politics, that actually go and read the stuff and do the news reporting and investigate. For some of these smaller towns, people can have a whole career going under the radar, right? If there's no reporter or there's no auditor really paying any kind of attention. Because technically it is legal, right? If there's no cap on how much someone can be paid, if they just keep giving themselves raises every 6 months, every year, and it just keeps adding up over and over until eventually a third of the town's budget is just going to paying the council or whatever. Like, the point I'm making is that in the absence of, this is why you need something like FEMA. You need something, this is where I have this disagreement with Trump, where he's, oh, just give all the money directly to the states. Some states aren't as good at allocating their resources. They're not as good or as kind, as it were, in allocating resources fairly to different parts of the states, that there's a lot of politics involved in who gets what when. And ostensibly, the FEMA is not supposed to do that. It's supposed to see that there's a problem and then respond equally to everyone who needs help. Ostensibly, we've seen in the age of Trump too, the second term, that's not necessarily always the case, that there are political considerations made as to who gets the money and specifically how fast they get the resources, if they get the resources. That's the big distinction that I've seen for this administration. is that there's a real animus, let's put it that way, towards helping states that didn't vote for Trump in the election in either the first or the second term. We're going to talk about that for one of the later topics, that you're seeing a much greater allocation of certain kinds of resources in places that Trump's not happy with and what's happening because of that. But that's a different topic. But in terms of this topic, there's definitely partisanship for giving emergency aid to places that need it after a natural disaster and inclement weather. It's just the way it is.
Yeah, I think that you bring up an interesting point concerning the fact that when it comes to local issues, local and let's say county in the non-populous county issues, and perhaps some non-populous states, that the electorate, even the involved electorate, is outclassed by those in power in terms of access to information, and therefore in terms of ability to speak in an informed fashion on topics. Like, there's definitely the possibility in many cases for the local government to commit the grift, if you will, to allocate the funds somewhere which is more in their own interests than in the public interests. I'm not saying most do, most probably do not, because, like, being on a city council or a school board, you don't make that much money. It's mostly public service, and it's a good place for aspiring, like, state legislator to go in the first place. What I am saying, and separate from the grift, is just the outclass because of the lack of reporting on these things. We have lots of reporting into the lives of celebrities or famous YouTubers, but not as much into what's your local city doing. And the ones that do, this is just what I suspect, the ones that do go to the city council meetings, some of them are often trying to get attention for themselves, and they might come off as, oh, that guy, yeah, oh yeah, he's always coming to the city council meeting. He begins every speech with America's falling behind. He's just a gimmick guy. But they do it so that they can get what little public involvement there is in the small area. And it really just comes down to, I think, a lack of reporting. One more quick thing. I've seen this on many a public meeting. The meeting is kind of like more just like a news session where the people say, here's what's going on, here's what's going on, here's what's going on. But it's straight from the horse's mouth. So is it motivated by these things?
I think that there needs to be a lot more money invested in local reporting, and that there unfortunately isn't in the U.S., that it's fallen to the wayside for a lot of these places. We saw that with that story in Texas where, for whatever reason, that congresswoman just didn't show up to her job for quite some time, and nobody asked the question, where is she? Who's doing the job that we elected them to do? But the city that I was talking about is Bell, California.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, and what they did is they had a series of phantom meetings and ghost meetings, and they put people on committees and all these things where they got extra money, and apparently their city manager was paid $1.5 million, which is a lot of money for a city with, I think what I was reading, it was 10,000 something people, right? That's a lot of money for someone to be paid in any public office. The president only makes 400 grand a year, technically, is the salary, and that's the whole country, right? And so if somebody's making more than that, one has to ask, what magic are they weaving? What are they doing that's incredibly valuable that they have to be compensated that much? Like, I understand that kind of compensation for a CEO of a corporation that has public shares or shareholders, right? Because they deliver certain measurable results in terms of like money made, profits, and that their compensation is usually tied to some kind of deliverable. But it's not so clear for a city manager what those deliverables are that they should be compensated $1.5 million. That's a lot of money.
No, I think we can safely say probably not. So we have concerns about where the focus and the funding is local level. And perhaps this stands in the way of a greater coordination and organization among society, and as a result, people live difficult lives in their own little houses, and they're disconnected from the stuff going on near them. So what do you think? What do you think would be better in theory? Do you think a few big cities would be better, or do you think, like, several towns, but they're, like, centralized within the town itself, and they're connected by railroads? I saw a bunch of sky bridges when I visited the Midwest, and I thought, oh, because it's cold a lot of the year. That makes sense. You'd want to be able to stay indoors. Calgary, up in Alberta, has got this huge system of sky bridges, which I was just inspired by when I visited there. Even in Spokane, they have a fair number. Maybe they have about as many as Bellevue does. Bellevue's got some.
The answer would be yes. It would be great if there was dedicated passenger rail in the United States, because right now the passenger rail is shared with commercial rail, right? So you have to divvy up the time to between cargo trains and commuter trains for things like Amtrak and some of these major railways. There are a few dedicated rails, subways and light rails and stuff like that. There's nothing where it's contiguous, right? There's no contiguous railway that connects every major town or city of the whole country. No, nothing close. The closest thing we've got to anything like that is the highway system, which is maintained by the federal government, right? And that is the thing, right? There's national security reasons for why it was even created. If you listen to why Eisenhower advocated for the highway system, we traveled all over Europe. It's like, they had terrible roads. We need really good roads for moving our stuff.
Yes.
Same argument could be made for rail, that we need to have rail that touches pretty much every corner of the continental U.S., even maybe through Canada up to Alaska, to ensure that we are able to get people and things to places fast enough, because it is a very big country. But that's a role that the federal government has to play, because they would have to engage most likely in eminent domain. That's what they did for the highways to make sure they got built, is they had to use eminent domain to, you know, give people the boot, say, we're going to pay you a bunch of money so you move out of the way and we can build this highway. Because otherwise you're going to have people who say, no, I don't want to move. I'm just not going to move. And then they won't move. And that poses operational costs and all sorts of logistical issues if you have to build a thing in a certain place in a certain way for it to be. So yeah, that is a role that the federal government is best suited to serve for something on that grand of a scale, because of the fact that it has the ability to seize property for projects.
But fortunately, if we did that, we would be going mostly through farms and rural areas.
Yeah, you still have to compensate everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to compensate people. Cool. Yeah. Anything to say about the storm itself?
Winter storms happen. The main notable thing about this storm is simply that it's bigger, right? It's bigger and it's in more places than normally expect icy, cold weather and snow. That's the big distinction. I guess my one other thing is that I see all these memes where, climate change, I thought everything was going to be warmer. No, that's not what climate change is. What climate change is, that weather patterns are changing. It's a change. It's different. That's why some places will get colder, some places will get warmer. And the issue is, when we're talking about preparedness and infrastructure and all that, a lot of this stuff is built on looking backwards, right? You look at past records of things that have happened, of flood trends, storm surge, the highest level of snowfall, ice, and you use those historical records to decide how strong you're going to make your buildings, how much your buildings are going to be built to mitigate things like earthquakes or things like hurricanes or anything like that. And the whole issue with climate change is that it's deviating from historical patterns and trends. That's the problem, is that as the climate changes and as the weather changes, places that may have been warm for a long time suddenly get cold, and places that were cold for a long time suddenly get way warmer. When we're talking about Greenland, why does Greenland matter so much? It's because the ice is melting in Greenland. A lot more land is opening up, and Greenland just happens to have a huge amount of resources and not a lot of people. And when you've got a huge amount of resources and not a lot of people, the places that really need a huge amount of resources go, oh, there's a huge amount of resources there for the taking, because there's not a lot of people in the way, right? I watched a documentary on Greenland. There's places all over Greenland that were abandoned because they were getting coal, and then coal became too cheap and they couldn't be profitable. So they abandoned a whole coal mining town, right? The whole island that it was booming, and then it went bust, right? They stopped making coal. Everybody left. So you've got this island full of empty buildings that are falling apart. Okay.
Right. Yeah. So the high costs, actually, even though they bad for the consumer, but it was good for the producer in that case, and the producer couldn't sustain it at lower prices, as in Venezuela, perhaps. Yeah, Greenland is going to have some climate change, and it's a big thing of ice, but it's not going to just be ice in the coming century, apparently. If we wanted it, it seems like this is exactly the way not to get it. But that comes later. That comes later. Did you see the thing about Clinton's in contempt of court?
I did, yeah. I read their response. I read the ongoing saga.
What was their response?
Oh, their response was just that this is not a legitimate legislative purpose. They don't want to do it, so they're not going to do it. And then they tried to negotiate a deal where they had an interview in Clinton's office instead of going in a public hearing in front of the committee. And that was turned down because the justification for why it was turned down was that they wouldn't have a permanent transcript. The Clinton said there would be a permanent transcript. You're just making it up. So the point is, this is a back and forth, but it's obvious that they're being targeted, right, for what looks like political persecution, because they're the only ones listed in the Epstein files at that level of political reputation that are being subpoenaed to testify. You don't see Trump being called in. You don't see, I'm not sure actually if they've called in Acosta. I think that's his name, the guy who gave the first sweetheart deal.
Sure. What about Summers? Have they called him in?
I'm not sure, actually. Not
okay.
Sure at all.
Okay.
But anyways, the point here is that they're obviously trying to come up with a predicate to hold the Clintons in contempt of Congress so they can fine them or put them in jail, because there's political reasons for that. This is part of Trump's campaign of retribution. It's a shiny object, right? During Biden's presidency, it was Hunter Biden all the time. Now that Biden's out of the presidency and Trump always needs a villain, they're dipping back into that very, very overutilized well of controversy, right? Because the Clintons funded ever since the 90s over all sorts of things. It's like the gift that never stops giving politically for the Republicans, because they just can't keep going after them. And because they're public figures and former politicians, they have limited recourse to actually challenge politicians from saying whingy things about, whining about them and saying annoying things about them, because they're celebrities. They are celebrities. They're very public people. So
yeah,
they don't have the same kinds of protections that your average nobody would have. There are certain things that can be said about them. There are certain practices that can be done with respect to them because of their political affiliation and connections that makes them juicy targets for the Republicans. And also it's an opportunity for the Republicans to always be backwards looking instead of focusing on the very limited release of the Epstein files and all this ongoing craziness going on with the protests and the ICE stuff, or talking even about Greenland and the craziness there. No, let's go back to a lot of these people made their career on, which was talking about the Clintons or impeaching the Clintons or whining about the Clintons.
Yeah.
There's a whole media landscape that's been built around the Clintons, of talking about them, writing books about them, making documentaries about them. It just never stops because there's money to be made.
Wouldn't you think, as I would, that if the Clintons, either of them or both, were jailed, just how much upwelling of popular support for them would result from that? Because clearly it would be a witch trial, and I just don't get it. I just don't get this constant looking for conflict.
It's the shiny object. Look, they're trying to create any distraction they can. So going into Venezuela, seizing Maduro, and putting him in U.S. custody, they're not talking about the Epstein files anymore. Talking about invading Greenland and using military force to disband NATO and to scare everybody, and those Greenlanders won't give up their big chunk of ice. Not talking about the Epstein files anymore. We're talking about the Clintons and holding the Clintons in contempt because they won't talk about the Epstein files. Not talking about Trump being in the Epstein files anymore. They're talking about The Clintons, like, they're trying a lot of different strategies to weasel their way out of, one, releasing the files in full, because it looks like that's not happening, or it's not going to happen for a long time. Or two, they're trying to distract what's within the files towards Clinton, so that they distract away from everything that mentions Trump or Reno, Trump in those files. That's what it looks like to me, that they're trying to engage in the politics of distraction.
Today, my administration is announcing the creation of the January 7th Committee, referring to January 7th, 1999, the Clinton impeachment trial, where he should have been found guilty. Everybody knew he was guilty, but 50 senators voted not guilty, not good. We are opening 50 investigations into those 50 senators. Just, like, where does the pettiness end? By the way, that was false. That was not what Trump said. But I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised.
Was Clinton's famous phrase? It depends on what the definition of is, or something like that, if I recall correctly, where he testified mm-hmm. and used squirrely weasel words to try and...
Yeah, he was a slick one, no doubt about it. But does he deserve what came at him? I don't think so.
Look, again, that was... So if you look at what happened, if you really want to know why the financial crisis happened, it's because of the Clinton impeachment. That the Republicans were using the impeachment as leverage to try and push through certain laws. The big one was to deregulate the banks so that they didn't have to be separate. Where the commercial investment and the savings had to be separate, they tried to combine them and to reduce the amount of reserve that they had to have at any time so that they could free up their money. That's what led in part to the subprime mortgages, and they were acting as investment bank. Anyway, the whole thing, I don't know why they're doing it now, because the Clintons are out of power. I think it's just distraction, but I do know for the impeachment that it was for leverage, that they were using it for political leverage to push through a bunch of legislation that Clinton signed. If you look at the last few months of Clinton's presidency, when he skated by with, I think it was one or two votes less than needed for him to get removed from office, he was a very adept politician. He hammered out a bunch of deals to pass certain types of legislation. I'll say this much for Trump. He's also a very adept political operator. Like, he knows where to squeeze, right? He understands how to keep the Republicans in line. Look at how effectively he's managed to keep them from just criticizing him in any meaningful way, of holding him in check in any meaningful way for anything that he's done. I can't name a single thing right now that the Republicans have done to actually rebuke him in any significant way, other than maybe one of the shutdown votes, one of the first ones where they passed that CR. But, like, I'm really struggling to see a point where the Republicans have exercised any real authority to hinder or to stop some of the egregious things that are happening. I haven't seen it.
Okay, now on to Trump declares victory on Greenland. So Trump said at Davos that the U.S. will have total access, but the issues of sovereignty over Greenland, I wrote, remain unsettled. Might say, I don't know that they have been addressed in terms of a resolution. Denmark still says that there will be no negotiation on sovereignty. Yeah, let's go with, why does Trump want Greenland?
Oh, that's an easy answer. It's the resources, it's money. If you look at a lot of the different moves that Trump's making, it's to secure money and resources after the presidency. So if you look at the Board of Peace, he's installed as like the chairman for life or something. Yeah. The point is that there's an eye on the exits. And one of the things that second term presidents focus on is after, right? It is what to do after being president. And Trump's a businessman. He makes a lot of money. He's made a lot of money. And one way to make money is to own access to resources, to mineral rights. But the way to get access to those things is to own Greenland first. National security is the stated justification, but that stated justification doesn't make any sense, because the United States at one point had 17 bases on Greenland during World War II and after World War II for a while. And we have a treaty with them that says we can pretty much have as many military assets and stuff as we want in Greenland for however long we want. Like, we have a treaty with them already. when he goes, oh, it's psychological, that he needs to own it, not lease it, because that gives you reason to defend it. No, we've got bases all over the world, okay? All over Europe. We've got bases at the DMZ, in the border between North Korea and South Korea. There's all sorts of places where the United States is unambiguously leasing land that they're then defending for very clear national security reasons. So I think the reason, this is common with Trump, that you have to come up with some stated reason to make it seem legitimate so that the other reason can be put into play. For example, Gaza is the one I'm thinking of, where the plan is to rebuild Gaza with resorts and skyscrapers and hotels. And do you remember that AI video they did where everyone was like dancing and laughing and happy in a rebuilt Gaza?
Unfortunately, that AI video is burned into my brain, yeah.
Where they're praising Trump and the golden statue of Trump.
And then there are those people in bikinis with long beards. Who even knows what that was?
Who knows? But that video, that's what I think of when I think of, was the ceasefire really about a ceasefire or peace? Or was it about putting in this resort hotel thing, the AI video? And same deal with Greenland. I think there's something else going on there. That there's a lot of resources, these rare earth minerals and other things in Greenland that are just ripe to be exploited. There's not a lot of people in Greenland. It's not like they're exploiting them. And part of the reason that these resources aren't being exploited right now has to do with the climate change, with the environment, that a lot of this stuff's buried under ice. I'm not sure you've noticed, but the Trump administration doesn't really care all that much about climate change. He hates windmills. He doesn't like green technology. He's opened up ANWR for drilling and oil rights and all sorts of things. There's a whole list of things where it's like, oh, they really do not care about climate change. That's where he wants to make Greenland green instead of being covered in ice.
Oh, jeez. Did you think of that one? That's a good one. That's a good one.
It's also a double entendre kind of thing.
Exactly.
The green from Greenland. Yeah. Make them money.
That's a good one.
But anyways, that's the whole point, is if the history of the United States is any indication, land conquest is to exploit the resources and to pave the way for industry and capitalism, right? Everything he does to make his friends richer and himself rich, if he can. But definitely to make his friends and donors and people richer. Like, the justification for invading Venezuela and capturing Maduro was to lift the oil sanctions and to start selling Venezuelan oil on the market and to exploit the oil resource. So I don't see the difference. The way that he seems to view the world is in stark money terms. Like, deep skepticism of any kind of alliance, international cooperation, international organization, except for corporations that are transnational and make huge amounts of money from things that make money. That's like the one exception.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of King Leopold of Belgium. Is that how they pronounce it in French? I don't know. But any case, and how he owned just the Congo, like the territory of the current Democratic Republic of the Congo. Is that the end game here? Is this going to be like Trump Greenland or something, or Trump Gaza? Is that the end game here?
Honestly, it looks like he's acting and operating like the age of empires, of colonialism, of there's stuff out there that I want, and there's weaker powers that have it, just they can move out of the way and we'll just take it. That's what it looks like. For Greenland, though, there is an argument to be made that he was creating the most extreme position to create a negotiating position to gain more of something. So
yeah.
That's one way that people negotiate for high-end sales tactics, is you throw out just like a preposterous number, $1 million, then you whittle it down to $100,000. And in this case, the extreme position could have been, we want Greenland for national security, but for any of our bases, we want to own that land that the bases are on. That could be the deal that's being made. So it's not, oh, I get all of Greenland. It's, I get little bits and pieces of Greenland. And every time I build a base on Greenland, I get a little bit more of Greenland. That could be the end goal, right? To expand the Overton window. And to make the extreme seem a little less, where the ask is something within the realm of the possible instead of completely abandoning NATO and sending the world into disarray and chaos.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense to me. So, now, since we've already put it in terms of this is what benefits Trump, the question of is it worth it seems to obviously issue forth, because is it worth it in terms of the relations with NATO? No.
No way.
Right, obviously. Go ahead.
Oh, there are extreme economic ramifications if the U.S. ever actually invaded Greenland and left NATO, because a lot of these countries have their gold in the U.S. To help pay off the U.S. debt and treasuries and stuff. And they give the U.S. liquidity for our debt and deficit. So do you remember when I'm actually thinking of Mark Carney being very creative when Trump was imposing just like those wide sweeping tariffs on the whole world? And then he backed down when the U.S. treasuries stopped being bought up because allegedly Mark Carney negotiated a deal with a bunch of other countries to start offloading U.S. treasuries. It made Trump panic. He's like, can't do that, because then you have no ability to operate as a government if you can't draw more debt. And so it could be one of those things. Like when he saw the stock market start plummeting, I think it went down like 2.5% or something when he started talking about invading Greenland. And it was like, can't do that. All my friends and rich pals are about to lose a bunch of money. Not good.
No, it could be a very costly negotiation tactic in terms of the economy, to say nothing of the cost of goodwill that we get from our European allies. What about the Board of Peace? You can clarify this. The Board of Peace, why don't you talk about the Board of Peace, what you know about it?
Oh, all I know is about the Board of Peace is that it's trying to operate as a, I don't know if it's an alternative to the UN or if it's in conjunction with the UN, but the point is that it's got a much different hierarchical structure compared to the UN, in that Trump would be appointed as like the top person and have veto power over the board. And also that there's two versions. There's the temporary members for countries of 3 years, and then if someone wants to be a permanent member on the board, they have to pony up $1 billion. But other than that, it's not so clear what the Board of Peace really wants to do other than oversee the ceasefire plan in Gaza. It's not so clear what else it's going to do. But what is definitely clear is that it's being set up as like a retirement option for Trump after he finishes up his second term, because he would still be the chairman of the board forever. Right. There's no limit. It's just one way to still accrue global political power after he leaves office.
And what does the $1 billion go toward?
Honestly, I'm not so sure. Like maybe just overseeing the ceasefire, making sure everything goes swimmingly. Like it's not entirely clear what it goes towards, that they're asking for the money for it. Maybe it's just operating. Like it's not entirely clear. Maybe operating expenses.
Okay. This is something that I will be watching with great interest.
I'm looking up what the $1 billion is for. The distinction is that it would be a private institution as compared to the UN is open to any sovereign country, right? That gets recognized as sovereign by the other sovereign countries. So the main distinction would be that it's like a club, like a country club or like a golf club.
Oh, La Club.
Like the club of peace, countries that contribute to their social chat hour about international peace and prosperity or whatever. It's very strange. I don't think it's going to compete with the UN ever unless all the countries join, and it doesn't look like they are. So the reason countries join the UN is because it serves as a global forum where they can talk about issues that affect everybody. And because the Board of Peace has such a narrow power structure that so much of the power is put in the hands of one person, Trump, it severely limits, I think, the appeal of the board for countries that want to actually participate in some kind of global rules-based order, because it just puts way too much power in the hands of him to veto stuff. At least for the UN, the General Assembly has a lot of latitude in terms of especially truth-seeking, that they can appoint special rapporteurs to answer questions about the world and the conditions of things that are occurring in the world that they want an answer to, like poverty, homelessness, human rights, all sorts of things. And it's not so clear that the Board of Peace has any real interest in things like human rights or the rules-based order. It's really unclear what their ultimate goals are other than the overseeing the ceasefire of Gaza. I don't know.
So I'm reading a CBC article about it, and it says that the countries, so apparently there have been 50 countries that have been asked to join. Notably, Canada was asked, but their invite was withdrawn, the only country in that category. a lot of countries are non-committal, and the only countries that have declined are France, Norway, Slovenia, Sweden, the UK, and Spain. Many have accepted. I don't know if they've paid the $1 billion. This is just such a unprecedented, and I previously said that things were unprecedented, and maybe you might agree, you might not, but I would say this really is pretty darn unprecedented for an individual to say, hey, countries, give this board $1 billion, and I'm the head of it, and I'm also the head of state of the United States. In that case, never, but I really just don't know what to make of this. This is very intriguing. But the thing is, it's only got 50 nations invited, and if you look at the map, most of those invited are in Eurasia. Only two, Egypt and Morocco, in Africa. Only 2/3 in South America, Argentina and Paraguay, and then France, so by effect, French Guiana. I don't even see the U.S. on here. I don't know where the U.S. falls in this. And then Canada was asked. And then it looks like they didn't ask Japan, according to this CBC article. Okay, I'm intrigued by this, but we gotta wait for it to flush out before we say more, I think.
It's very strange. Ultimately, what's most strange about it is that it's only got one person as, like, the head person that has veto power, which is a departure. It's different than other international organizations.
Okay, Lisa Cook, Fed Independence. Lisa Cook's from the St. Louis Fed on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, I believe. She was accused of mortgage fraud, but not charged of mortgage fraud, and not given the opportunity to reply prior to her termination. Is Trump, like, gunning for Fed independence so that the Fed would be more subservient to him? What is the importance of an independent Fed? And is he suing Jerome Powell, too? And is that part of this whole thing? What do you think?
Yeah, so for Jerome Powell, he's apparently under a criminal investigation for alleged, I don't know, misspending or something for the renovations of the Federal Reserve. But this saga has been ongoing. So initially, they tried to fire Lisa Cook, but there was a rule that says you can't fire someone on the Fed without cause. And so it looks like they're trying to find pretext for cause, right? That they're pretty much grasping at the proverbial straws of combing through every little thing to find something and make it stick so that they can fire someone on the Fed board. And all of this goes back to Trump trying to influence when the rates are increased or decreased for the interest rate.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve rate. Yeah, the discount rate.
The one power that the Fed really has.
Yeah.
That Trump...
Quantitative easing is easy, but yeah.
Sure. But the main power that the Fed has, the one it's most known for because it has a degree of discretion for when to do it. But the point is that Trump, like other presidents before him, complains about the Feds because of the effect it has on the economy. And Trump wants to have more of an effect on the economy so that he can complete his political objectives, whatever they happen to be. And so this looks like manipulation of the Fed. That's what it looks like from just me as a lay observer with a degree in political science, that the Fed is an independent institution by design because it has to create trust. The economy is a trust-based system. People invest in the economy because they trust that their investments will be secure and that it's not going to, like, wildly fluctuate and go crazy every day, that there's at least some degree of predictability. And the Fed has a dual mandate. The mandate is low unemployment, low inflation, both at the same time, if they can do it. And so to do that, they have a delicate balance that they have to follow. And you would hope that competent, educated, careful people would be the ones who are looking at what the balance needs to be and making that balance occur. The problem with Trump trying to influence the Fed in this way is that Trump, for all his success as a politician, is not a professional economist. He's not a banker, such that he has, like, that expert, you know, perspective and knowledge to understand what the best paths and strategies are for that dual mandate of low inflation, low unemployment. And this whole saga is creating this level of uncertainty that's really scary, because nothing quite like this has happened in the United States of a president trying to put their thumb on the scales. So yeah, I think it's right that it went to the Supreme Court for this Lisa Cook thing, because there has to be a degree of sort of church and state, a degree of independence between the Federal Reserve and the president. There just has to be, because the president has in his power the ability to unilaterally fire millions of people, which we've seen. And that would mean that if he tried to influence the Fed, he's directly interfering with their mandate of low unemployment by making a whole bunch of people unemployed. That was the Doge effort. And so if he's trying to juice the numbers with the interest rates because of his impact on unemployment from firing all these people, right, that's political malpractice. It's terrible, right? Because it's not as if these people were fired because they weren't, in all cases, not doing their job, or they were like a drain on the economy or something. No, it was a stated goal to reduce the federal workforce for political reasons, right? Where so he could brag that, if you listen to his speech that he gave, I listened to his whole hour and 40 minute press conference or whatever it was, where they listed all the accomplishments. And one of the accomplishments he listed was that 100% of job growth was in the private sector and no job growth in the federal government. Okay, what does that mean? That means he fired an awful lot of people and then didn't hire any people. Like, that has economic ramifications that would be mitigated if he could influence interest rates, right? So he can mask the impact on the economy by making it seem better or rosier than it is. But that there's a danger there. That's why the Fed has to be independent. Because in countries where you have central control over the economy, that's how you get circumstances that can lead to extreme hyperinflation. Think Zimbabwe, or even the Weimar Republic, right? Wheelbarrows full of cash, right? For a loaf of bread. You need this independence. It's not a luxury. It's something that's a necessity for a stable, functioning economy in a modern, civilized world.
Right. Because it's important because the interest rate is there so that the cost of acquiring money is not too low in boom times and is not too high in bust times. And as a counter-cyclical mechanism to the economy, so that the booms aren't too high, or indeed the busts aren't too low. And the value of a currency has a lot to do with the perceived rule of law and independence and robustness of the institutions of the country to which that currency belongs. I could probably put that in a more concise way, but as does investment in a country. People invest in a country because they believe in a degree of predictability. And if there is this counter-cyclical mechanism of the interest rate dampening the booms and shortening the busts, that's predictability, and that's what people expect. And might not get as much investment if we don't have that. And that investment could include buyers of U.S. bonds. So if we have the Federal Reserve, saying the interest rate is 1%, and then we can't find buyers for U.S. treasuries at 1%, which is at a low yield, we've got problems if we can't find buyers for U.S. treasuries.
The U.S. is in a position where we absolutely need an independent Fed. Our debt's really high. We need a lot of people to buy our debt pretty much every day to keep everything running. And unless Congress suddenly decides they're going to figure out a way to create a budget surplus, which I'm skeptical, we absolutely need this trust-based mechanism in place to dampen the effects of extreme, you know, market fluctuation. And honestly, like, I was very surprised that there's a criminal investigation being opened into Jerome Powell, because technically, if he really wants to, Trump can just fire him. But instead of doing that or waiting out his term, he's trying to do a runaround of encouraging. Let me be clear. It's not clear that Trump demanded the investigation of Powell. This could be something that the Department of Justice is doing of their own volition.
Yeah. This is all alleged. This is a podcast. This is not a news agency.
It's not clear who demanded the investigation of Jerome Powell, but it is clear that there is an investigation of Jerome Powell. And what that looks like to me is that instead of facing the political repercussions of just firing Jerome Powell if he doesn't like Jerome Power trying to fire him and it going to the Supreme Court and looking bad. Instead, they're trying to oust him by chasing him away with this investigation, which we'll see, right? The investigation will play out. And if there's charges to be made, they'll be charged. And if there's an indictment, there's an indictment. That's the nature of federal investigations. But at the end of the day, it doesn't look good. I don't think this is anything quite like this has ever happened. So it's not great. I mean,
you've never seen anything like it. This is
nothing quite like this.
Mondays with Mike.